first time the organizers of putting together this great event and for giving me the opportunity to introduce the speaker. So, today's topic is a little bit mind-cracking. Mostly on band structure, stories of band structure. But I'm also maybe shortly commenting on the other effective aspects of this. So, this talk mostly contains two parts. First part I want to actually discuss about topological aspects of atoms in analogy to topological topology of band structure. So, because we know we have magnetic spin waves in a magnet, in a crystal structure, they also hold some energy bands. So, my natural question is what's the topology of those bands? So, I'm going to address that first question. So, in particular, I want to emphasize a few important results before I go into the details. So, I want to emphasize some important difference of the electronic counterparts and this magnetic situation. In the case of magnetic, what I'm going to show you is usually in electronic band structure, like in the most familiar cases, TI, topological insulator, then you have some surfaces which are.
Sorry, but this is your recording purpose.
Okay, so let me first comment on the difference of the topology in a linear spin wave compared to the electronic system. So in electronic system, typically the most common topology we would see about the surface state of TI is that when you have certain bulk bands with a bulk gap at zero energy, you have some surface state which live on the zero energy, right? So in the case of magna, this is actually quite different. What you can show is, as I will show you later, is that you cannot have any zero frequency surface magnons sitting within the bulk gap. So that's impossible. So that you can prove some no-go theorem. So that's one important part of our results.
So could you repeat what's the statement of this theorem, which you cannot have states?
You cannot have topological surface states of magnons at zero frequency, which are within the bulk gap. So in the case of magnon band structure, as will become clear soon, the positive energy band and negative energy band are always symmetric. There are certain kind of particle symmetry in the magnon Hamiltonian. So this is the first big difference, is that for magnon, there is no state within a gap, in contrast to electron. However, you could have some non-trivial topology between these finite energy bands in the case of magnon. So you could have surface state, for example, living here. So these can be your surface state. And you can have a full classification for these topological magnons. So that's another part of the result. And I also want to mention there is one kind of very interesting difference of the magnon system and the spins and electronic system is that in the case of magnon, there can be also something that never shows up in the case of electrons. So in the case of magnon, sometimes you also have surface state, which are above all the bulk magnon bands. So these are actually discovered a long, long time ago, known as the Damon-Eschbach mode. Damon-Eschbach. So this mode shows up as a consequence of the long-range dipole-dipole interaction between the spins. Yes?
So here, excuse me, so we are talking about 2D, 3D surface means edge modes or really 3D surface?
Any
mode?
Dimension, 2D and 3D. Mm. Yeah, so yeah, when I say surface state in 2D, there'll be edge state. Mm. Yes?
Sorry, under which conditions do you have this particle hole symmetry?
Generically, for all the, basically for all the band structure of magnons. I'll show that. So maybe you're thinking about like ferromagnets, right?
I was thinking about a few different things that we've worked on.
Right. It should become clear soon. I should be able to convince you that. In the case of ferromagnet, basically, what we are doing is we are treating the magnon Hamiltonian in terms of BDG formalism. So in that case, you naturally have a particle symmetry. So in the case of ferromagnet, if you consider both the particle and the hole part, that'll be particle symmetry in essence. Yeah, okay. The second part is, if I have some time, I'll talk about a topology and flow dynamics of magnons. Meaning, if you shine a light on a magnetic order material, can you drive some flow surface state, which are topological? So I'm gonna give you a very, very simple example for that one. Okay, so so let me start by setting up the framework to understand the topology of magnon. So the kind of problem we want to focus on is linear spin wave. So we start, let's say we start from some microscopic Hamiltonian, which contains generically some arbitrary bilinear interaction between spins. So I use I and J to label my magnetic site. And I use alpha and beta to label my component string, which can take x, y, z, or the component. So the general Hamiltonian convention has j beta plus alpha xj beta plus some other term. So the starting point of a linear spin wave is that first you minimize this Hamiltonian classically. You find its classical ground state. So the classical ground state is given by some ordering pattern, meaning the spins take some expectation value. Plus some fluctuation. So these are numbers, then these are fluctuations around this classical minima. So classical minima is determined by the minimization of energy. And in order to for the magnet to be stable, you have to realize this has to be at least local minimum of the system. So therefore, this also give rise to certain conditions on the expansion after we expanded around this minimum of the Hamiltonian. So once we start to expand this minimum, we can write down some effective Hamiltonian in terms of these small variables, which are fluctuations around the classical minimum. So without loss of generality, I want to choose actually a convenient framework to study the whole problem. So in particular, I want to choose a framework where all the spins orders along z direction. So for example, in the case of ferromagnetic system, I don't need to do anything. Here, spin is already aligned along the z direction, right? But imagine you have antiferromagnet. So what I want to do is I want to do some local rotation. On this odd side, I want to rotate spin along x direction by 90 degrees. So that after this rotation, in this local rotated basis, every spin is aligned to z direction. So that's just for the simplicity for the treatment. I'm changing the basis, but the physics is not affected by that. So after choosing that basis, I will be ended up with the ordering wave vector is given by expectation value is given by 0, 0, and s. S is the magnitude of my spin, right? Because it's always aligned along z direction. And there is also some fluctuation around this ordering moment. So basically, si alpha in this order region can be written as six, siy. These are some small fluctuations, the spin wave variables, around this ordering moment. And the z component is basically a smaller variation. It's s squared minus si x squared minus si y squared.
So the
statement, okay,
so the classical expectation value and without?
This is a fluctuation. I'm now considering fluctuation on top of the classical expectation value.
Right. Just for the notation's sake, the Brocken average in HINA means a classical expectation.
That's correct. Yes, yes. By the way, feel free to solve me anytime, okay, if you have any question. Yeah, this is supposed to be informal and pedagogical. So now I can start to expand the basically my effective Hamiltonian using these small variations around the order moment, right? So after doing that expansion, I arrive at some linear spin wave Hamiltonian. So the linear spin wave Hamiltonian is really written in terms of only these two components, the fluctuations. So I want to write them as, there is a normalization factor, 1 over s I added here, just for convenience. Sum over ij, sum over alpha beta, ij are lattice, alpha beta equal to x and y, si alpha, sj beta. And there is a matrix which describes the linear spin wave dispersion, it's rij alpha beta, plus some higher order term, typically, sp. Yeah. So that's my linear spin wave pattern. So in the linear spin wave approximation, I'm going to only keep up these terms, right? Forget about all the other higher order terms. So and then what I want to do is to dabble at this Hamiltonian. This basically will give me the spin wave dispersion. And all the things like topology, surface state should come out of this equation. So what we really want to study is the topology of this equation. But what I want to show very soon is that when you try to dabble at this problem, it turns out to be a non-Hermitian problem. So you somehow have to use some trick to map this to a Hermitian problem, to use the result which we know about electronic gas function. So one way to get the spectrum, to dabble at this problem is to derive the equation motion, right? So now we already have order moment along z direction. So if I have order moment along z direction, then we have the commutation relation. So SIX, SJY, or generally alpha and beta, equal to when alpha and beta take the value of x and y for the small fluctuation.
they equal to IH bar epsilon alpha and beta. And we know the SZ component is ordered, right? And delta IG. And in particular, the order value is taken as S. So here I can replace, in the linear spin wave perturbation, I can replace the SZ component system by a constant S. So therefore, it's obvious here that the small fluctuation X and Y around this ordered moment, they behave like a canonical momentum and position, the conjugate variables.
You mean at this point you're ignoring the fluctuations? You don't want to write down the square root?
No. This is what we will use in the linear spin wave approximation. All the others in the higher order equations. And doesn't affect the linear spin wave spectrum. Yes, so after introducing this one, then I can start to derive the equation motion for this linear spin wave Hamiltonian. So equation motion is given as IH bar. So for alpha equal to x and y.
So yes. For this commutation relation, the left-hand side is order of S squared. In the operator, order, right?
Order of S.
S I alpha times S j beta is 2S. So it's order of
You're thinking about them as a vector, like a classical vector proportion. But they are really small fluctuation. They're really small. I'm just writing, this is initially this is a quantum mechanical commutation relation.
Yes, I mean the square root also will give you a square. Operator square. So
square root of
square. I mean, you replace the SZ by S directly, but
that's
it should have been some square root S square minus SIR X squared.
I think we're just using different normalization condition or different definition for the operator. But that really doesn't matter. You know, if you redefine this SI alpha as S times SI alpha, you get what you are saying. But it's really like a different definition for this operator. It's fine. I'm just using the quantum mechanical commutation relation for angular momentum, the usual one.
I mean, my question is similar to Andrew, that maybe you need to, why did you?
It doesn't really matter, I guess. You're suggesting me to write SI alpha as S times SI alpha, which is also okay.
Yeah, I know that.
Which it doesn't matter at all.
The right-hand side of this.
Uh-huh.
He's asked about the square root just like I was a moment.
Oh, you mean for this part?
Yeah, the square root, if you take an expansion, do a Taylor expansion, it will give you SIX squared, something like that.
Right, you mean there's some correction on the right hand side?
Yeah, this correction is
but this correction is higher order. So in a linear spin wave approximation, you shouldn't consider these expansions.
What did you mean, order? Higher order, this order.
Higher order meaning. Okay, I mean, let me use another model familiar formulation for the spin wave problem. Usually, when people do spin wave, one standardized way to do it is to use this Holstein Primakov Boson representation.
Yeah.
By higher order term, I mean higher order term in terms is A or A dagger operator.
Okay.
Like, if you try to write down that Hamiltonian, if you keep, say, A to the cube term, those are what I call higher order term.
Okay.
They correspond to these things.
Okay.
Yeah. Here, I'm simply representing that problem in this representation. Because somehow it's convenient for me to study this representation. Yeah. Okay. So these are actually quite standard stuff. So now you can start to do this computation relation, right? And then you can plug in this equation. And what you're going to end it up with is the following. Is you're going to have I h bar epsilon alpha beta. Then we know the Hamiltonian has this matrix R. You have R, I, J, beta, gamma, S, J, gamma. And this is factor 1 over S is canceled by the factor of S in the commutation relation. So you're going to end up with this kind of equation motion. So remember this epsilon is anti-symmetric tensor. So I times epsilon is exactly polymatrix U by Y, the second polymatrix. So therefore, what we have shown in this case is that if you try to derive the equation motion for SI alpha, you're going to end up with polymatrix sigma y multiply this matrix R, this matrix in this linear spin wave Hamiltonian times into ij and alpha beta of sj of beta. Okay, so this is basically the linear spin wave problem you're actually diagonalizing. Although the Hamiltonian matrix, this R matrix is typically called dynamical matrix. So dynamical matrix is Hermitian, it's real symmetric. But dynamical matrix itself doesn't give you the eigenvalue for the linear spin wave problem. Instead, it's this matrix. This is real matrix which determines the linear spin wave spectrum. Now you can obviously see your problem. You know, in an electronic band structure, the matrix will block Hamiltonian by diagonalizing its Hermitian. But this one is not really generally Hermitian, right? Because if you take the Hermitian conjugate R times sigma y, and sigma y and R typically do not commute. So this one is really a non-Hermitian problem. In fact, in the formulation of these non-Hermitian matrices, this property is called a pseudo-Hermitian, pseudo-Hermiticity. In the sense that sigma y times R dagger sigma y equal to R. Sigma y times this matrix I'm diagonalizing. And sigma y equal to this matrix I'm diagonalizing. So this matrix is pseudo-Hermitian. However, unfortunately, pseudo-Hermiticity generally doesn't guarantee the spectrum is real. So in fact, you can find some example. For example, this matrix R, if you put this matrix to be some matrix with a negative eigenvalue, then you can show generally you can have imaginary eigenvalue for sigma y times R. People have found example like that. So now, our question is, how do I understand topology? Yes.
Yeah, so I'm a bit confused. This respect, we don't write the equation of motion, but if we use the kinetic term, which is the normal Berry phase term, and you kind of distribute it such that it's half of, like, instead of writing it A dot Q dot, you write it as AQ half minus Q, like, exchange the spin variables, and then diagonalize the whole thing.
Using this boson variable?
Yeah.
Holstein-Kreimacher boson, like, is that?
Right, so...
Is that what you were referring to?
Right. In general, if you write down a kinetic term that is like this coherent kind of integral of the spin derivative and not use the equation of motion directly, I think you don't encounter this problem.
I'm not sure. I fully understand the problem. Maybe we can talk more later. This is just another way to represent the linear spin wave problem. If you can use also a different representation. Let me show another more familiar representation just to compare with this one. So now the more familiar representation is the Holstein-Kreimacher free representation. In that case, if the SV is in the order value, let's say S minus A dagger A, A is my boson creation annihilation operator, then SX plus ISY, which is my S plus operator, is square root of 2S minus A dagger A times A. So in this case, you can also start to write down these spin variables, Hamiltonian using these variables. And then you can write down actually sort of a BDG Hamiltonian using these A and A dagger variables. Because generally this is a BDG Hamiltonian without, let's say, U1 spin conservation. In very special cases, like ferromagnet, it will be actually a hopping Hamiltonian. There is no pairing. But generally you will have both hopping and pairing. Times some matrix, let me call this H. So in this representation, this is the usual familiar Holstein-Kreimacher representation for linear spin wave. And you can show this one just differ by some unitary transformation. Because these variables, you can immediately see this A, roughly in the linear spin wave representation, 2S times A, is the same as my SX plus ISY, the small variation. So there is just some linear transformation you should make between A and A dagger to A, SX and SY. So in that problem, it's also kind of similar. In the end, what you're going to diagonalize in order to obtain the linear spin wave spectrum is actually sigma z times this matrix H, instead of H itself. So again, generally, this will be a non-Hermitian problem. So this one is equivalent to this one just by unitary transformation, given by this.
So yeah. Now, the partial case would be if you have a spin rotational symmetric Hamiltonian.
Right.
So if the matrix J out ij is a unity in alpha beta indices, then this problem doesn't appear, correct?
That's right. So in that case, it's very special. So Andre is referring to actually a special situation, say it's a usual ferromagnet. When you have usual ferromagnet, it turns out there is a very special property for this R. For example, this R can be just the identity matrix. So in that case, R can commute with sigma y. If R commutes with sigma y, this matrix immediately becomes Hermitian by itself. So that's like a very trivial version of this situation.
But my point is, this is not just ferromagnet. Take any L state square lattice, that's true.
You mean antiferromagnet? No, you cannot do this for antiferromagnet, turns out. Antiferromagnet, you need to have actually pairing term.
But again, if I look at how you define the matrix R,
right?
R is defined by
N. R is defined in the linear spin wave Hamiltonian.
That's right.
After
yes.
Expand. Yes.
So the fact that it has dependence on alpha, beta,
mm-hmm.
instead of being rotationally invariant, is it not the consequence of your J generally being rotationally non-invariant?
No, it's not only depend on the initial Hamiltonian, also depend on ordering pattern. So if the ordering pattern is feral, then this R is really just identity matrix, as you have said. So in that case, indeed, this one is a Hermitian matrix. But even if it's anti-feral, it's still not. They don't commute, generally. In most cases, they don't commute.
Right. But so help me resolve the problem. Most people in this room have done the Holstein Kerckhoff calculation for an AL anti-ferromagneton as well.
Yeah. And it's real.
Are real.
Yes, yes, that's right. I'm going to explain. I'm going to explain why it's real. Yeah, yeah. So it turns out that actually, although this matrix is not really Hermitian, there is actually a trick you can do to make this a Hermitian matrix. So remember, we are looking at actually a stable magnet, meaning it's a minimal of the free energy. So these matrices are actually positive definite, right? The fluctuation has to be lower bounded. It doesn't really, you cannot further lower the energy. So if this probably is satisfied, then what you can do is you can take a square root of R. Remember, R is actually a real symmetric and Hermitian matrix. So you can take a square root of R, meaning if you can diagonalize R as some unitary times D times unitary dagger. So square root of R meaning, and this D is all positive, then square root of R is unitary times square root of D times U dagger. Okay, so you can take a square root of it. The fact that you can take a square root is very important to show that actually you always get real eigenvalue. So remember that diagonalizing this matrix sigma y times R. But I can always do actually a similarity transformation. I can left multiply sigma square root of R, right multiply inverse of this matrix, if it's invertible, if it's positive definite. It's invertible. If it's invertible, then I ended up with another matrix. And this matrix generally have the same spectrum as the origin matrix, for sure. And if this R is a short-range interaction between these magnons, then this is also a local transformation, so it doesn't change locality. So therefore, by using this spectral preserving and locality preserving transformation, I can end up with a new Hamiltonian, which is purely Hermitian. And this one, you can think of this as an electronic band structure. So you can use all the tricks you use for the electrons to study the topology in this case. Yeah, so basically that's the trick to overcome this situation. So this is why the eigenvalues are always positive. Yeah. Okay. So, and then, yes.
So in this magnet program, you mean this R is always positive simply?
Yes, non-negative definite, I would say.
Okay.
Let's say in the case of say Gaussian mode, it can have zero eigenvalue. Mm-hmm. But in that case, it's okay. It's also okay. Even with that, 1, 0 is fine. Yeah.
So non-negativity flows from what?
Oh, it's from the fact that it's stable magnetic order. Remember, we're expanding around some minimum. So the second order, variation is always positive. Yeah. So so this is pretty much the trick you use to understand these the static spectrum of the magnons. In that case, the topology can be understood in terms of their counterpart in the electronic band structure. So you can play all the game in the electronic band structure. So, okay, the next thing I want to show you is, actually, there is no Gauss theorem that tells you that you cannot have zero frequency surface magnons. So, it turns out there are very simple picture to understand this. So, usually in the case of TI, the fact there is a bulk boundary correspondence, right? Whenever you have zero frequency surface state, it suggests the bulk it has a non-trivial topology, right? The ground state of the bulk has non-trivial topology. However, we know in the case of magnons, the ground state is actually trivial. It's product state, because all the spin is frozen. They align to a certain order direction. So the ground state is topologically trivial. So if the ground state is trivial, you don't expect this. So you should be surprised if you really ended up with something like that. So naively, you shouldn't really expect that. But what you can do is you can actually prove this is always, you really cannot have any zero frequency surface state. The way to do it is the following. So in the case of the electronic band structure, a trick we usually use is a flattened band trick. So if I'm interested in the topology at zero energy, I can flatten all the positive energy band into the same energy, say plus one, and all the negative energy band with the same energy minus one. Okay, I forgot to mention one thing, is that the spectrum of this one does have particle symmetry. In the following sense, sigma R is a real matrix, so if I take a complex conjugation, I get a minus one sign. So therefore, this matrix has actually a symmetric particle and whole spectrum.
Because
this is why it's completely particle symmetric. Okay. So, so in this case, if I use this flattened band trick, then the spectrum is basically completely plus one and minus one. Okay. So now we want to ask ourselves, how do I show that it's topologically trivial within that gap? So the trick is the following. So in order to diagonalize this matrix this Hamiltonian to get a spin wave spectrum, it turns out the problem you are trying to diagonalize is actually the following problem. You want to find a matrix W satisfying W dagger sigma y W equal to sigma y. So meaning this means this W matrix belongs to SP to an R on the field R. And you want this W to diagonalize your matrix R equal to some diagonal matrix. And in this case, the diagonal matrix is just identity in a flattened band limit because all the energy are exactly degenerate. So
could you repeat what was the first condition? The fact that it commutes with sigma y, that was...
I'm basically rewriting the diagonalization equation. So the usual diagonalization equation you write down is sigma y times R times some matrix W equal to W times sigma y times some diagonal matrix, in this case it's identity, right? And another thing you want to make sure is this W doesn't change commutation relation, because the boson variable has certain commutation relation. So this, the first condition is that it keeps the same commutation relation. Yeah, just like the fermion case is when you diagonalize a matrix, it's a unitary matrix. So U dagger U is one. You don't change the anti-commutation relation. So basically, sigma y is some sort of metric. When you diagonalize these quadratic Hamiltonian, you want to keep the metric invariant under this transformation. So therefore, these are the kind of matrices which we the diagonalization condition which we want to satisfy. And there is one actually property for this SP to an R matrix, is that there is a standard form for this symplectic matrix. And you can write W in terms of some U, term some matrix which you can write as lambda inverse. Lambda is the angle, and there is a V. U and a V are always unitary matrices. So generally, SP to an R matrix has a standard form. And as you put it in there, then the fact that R equal to the R has a flat band spectrum tells you that R equal to W dagger inverse times W inverse from the second equation, and then you can easily write this as V dagger lambda inverse times V. Okay, so once you have that property, this lambda, yes?
If you went too fast for me. So W are the eigenvectors.
That's right.
The metal band, the only thing that they make, the eigenvalues make a flat band.
That's right. Yes. We're just flattening a spectrum, keeping the same eigenstate. But it's a symplectic matrix, so it has this property. And then the point is, this matrix is also positive. It has all the positive eigenvalue. And all the eigenvalues are larger than 1. So lambda inverse has eigenvalues smaller than 1. So so the trick is that you already have some sort of standard form for this matrix R. And now the next thing you want to do is you want to adiabatically tune this matrix R into an identity matrix. So the way to do it is to just, again, flatten the spectrum of this lambda. Initially, lambda has positive eigenvalue larger than 1, positive eigenvalue smaller than 1. You just push them towards 1. As you push them towards 1, you can show in that process, first of all, this gap at zero frequency does not close. And then all the eigenvalues doesn't close. So in that process, you basically find a continuous path where you tune this matrix R into identity matrix. And if R is an identity matrix, in the language of the fermion, this will just be atomic superconductor. So it's on-site S-wave pairing on every side. So that kind of atomic superconductor always have trivial topology. So shortly speaking, what I'm trying to say is in the case of flattened band cases, I can find a continuous path between any linear spin wave, which are stable, meaning this R is positive definite, and there is a gap at zero frequency, I can always tune this into a very, very simple limit without closing gap, without changing topology, keeping the same symmetry that R equal to identity. If R equal to identity, obviously has trivial topology. This is in real space identity matrix. So therefore, in that case, of course, it's topologically trivial. So therefore, you have shown the topology at this zero frequency is always trivial.
Sorry, how does zero frequency enter this discussion? I mean, I followed everything until you said zero frequency.
That enters in the sense that the spectrum of R never changes once you do that trick. So you see, this is part of the eigenwave function, right? So you're changing the eigenwave function adiabatically. Spectrum remains the same. So zero frequency is never touched. There's always a gap there. This median spectrum is still just plus one and minus one. It's the same. Yeah. So I'm just adiabatically tuning the wave function without changing energy, without closing the gap. So therefore, you think topology at zero frequency would never be changed by that adiabatic tuning. Yeah. Okay. So this is a little technical. Yes.
This lambda is the diagonal matrix.
Yeah. So lambda.
The same eigenvalue.
No, the eigenvalue are all larger than one.
Okay.
Larger or equal than one, and lambda inverse is smaller or equal than one. It's just some standard form as p2n. Yeah, which help us to prove it. There may be other way to prove it, but this is one way I do it. Yeah, so, okay, so what I've shown is basically the no-go theorem, that at zero frequency, you cannot have any symmetric rotating magnetic surface state. I mean, symmetry is, of course, implemented on these matrix. Yeah, so let me also comment a little bit on symmetry. So you can also ask yourself, how do I implement a symmetry in a system?
Symmetry's implementation.
So let me talk about two situations. Just yes.
In the paper by Murakami, there was some similar no-go theorem.
It's Chernobyl, right? Called Chernobyl.
Yes. How does that relate to your?
That's a good point. I think what they did is they just directly compute the Chernobyl, and they show the Chernobyl has to vanish. They just compute the Chernobyl. But here, and this is, yes.
They actually do an argument similar to this, where they interpolate between a general spin wave matrix to the identity matrix and say this is a path where they don't close the.
And in that case, the Chernobyl will vanish. I think they use the Chernobyl formula in the original.
They do both. So they show that the Chernobyl vanishes, and they also show that you can construct a path between an arbitrary spin wave Hamiltonian and a trivial one.
Yeah. But in that case, they don't have any symmetry, right?
Right, if they're realized linearly or anti-linearly,
it follows
immediately.
Yeah. I guess here what you can also show is this path doesn't really change the symmetry of the system, no matter what's the original symmetry of the system. It never changes. Yeah. So let me comment on that. So the symmetry implementation, so let me think about, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. The first one is unitary symmetry. So unitary symmetry, one simplest example is SIX, SIY. You can just do a rotation along z-axis, right? U1 rotation. So this matrix in my language is the exponential of I theta sigma y. Yeah. So therefore the unitary symmetry generated basically by a matrix, which is like sigma y. And you can show generally unitary symmetry commutes with the matrix R. Let's say unitary symmetry, let me call it U, unitary matrix. Let me call it OU. This is the generator for the unitary symmetry. So OU commutes with R, and also OU commutes with Pauli matrix sigma y, just like U1 spin rotation. So you can also think about anti-unitary symmetry in this case. If it's anti-unitary symmetry, one example is you can have actually a time-reversal symmetry. So think about if you have a ferromagnet pointing along z-direction. What you can do is you can do a spin rotation along x-axis by 180 degrees, and then do time-reversal. Everything still comes back, right? So under that transformation, what you can show is if I'm doing 180-degree rotation along x-axis, then SIX, because the time-reversal becomes minus SIX. And SIY initially is rotated to minus SIY. And then after time reversal comes back. So this is generally the formation for the anti-unitary symmetry. So for anti-unitary symmetry, the matrix associated with the matrix here is actually O anti-unitary symmetry is minus 1 and plus 1, acting on my variables. So this one is just sigma z. And you can generally show if it's anti-unitary symmetry, the anti-commute with sigma y, the metric in your problem.
And this matrix also commutes the Abelian.
Yeah, so. Anti-unit is generated by some matrix.
Yeah, but why do we consider anti-unitary matrices now? What was the jump from unitarity to then?
I just want to use these two as an example to show the general different form of symmetry implementation in the system. In the case of unitary symmetry, it commutes with sigma y. In the case of anti-unitary, it anti-commutes sigma y. This is a general property for the linear spin wave. No matter what symmetry you're talking about, spatial or global, they have to set it at that condition. So. Yeah, so once you have this condition, you can talk about all kind of symmetry implementation. Since we have already mapped the sort of non-Hermitian Hamiltonian of the linear spin wave to the Hermitian Hamiltonian of, say, Fermionic band structure, we can use all the kind of symmetry class tenfold way in the fermion case to understand the linear spin wave case. Yeah. So, and then you can get some table. Maybe let me just comment on some example in that table. So, you can talk about, for example, class A. So class A would be just some magnetic system with no symmetry. So if you talk about dimension 1 and 2 and 3, so for example, you can have some chiral magnet with no time or symmetry. So in one dimension, the classification is trivial Z. So it's actually very similar to the fermion case. 2D is just integer, trend number, and 3D is trivial again. And you can also talk about point node in the system, right? So we know in that case, the point node band touching, I should say, random band touching. The band touching between these finite frequency Magnum band. So in those cases, the band touching in one dimension has an integer, class 2D is trivial, 3D is integer again. This is class A with no symmetry. You can also talk about class A1. This is with a time-versal symmetry. But T squared is plus 1. For example, for this kind of time, that's what I'm talking about. So there, this is also one big difference between magnetron and electron. In electron, T squared is always minus 1. But in a magnetron, because they're both on T squared, generally plus 1. So it's a different symmetry class. So you don't usually have the quantum spin holder sort of class. So in this case, unfortunately, all of them are trivial. Yeah. So time also just kills all the topology in this case. Yeah. And that's the only example I want to talk about here.
So class A1 has T squared equal 1, correct?
Sorry?
Class A1 has T squared.
Yeah, T squared equal to plus 1. Yeah. And in this case, we can also check this anti-unitary symmetry, for example, square to be plus 1. Yeah. Yes?
I mean, how do you define time universal? I mean, the state you are starting from is breaking time universal.
That's right.
By itself.
Yeah. The time universal is a combination of spin rotation and time universal. You first rotate spin along x-axis and time universal. Okay, so this is why the square of the operation is plus 1. Yeah. Because spin rotation also gives you some. So, so that's for basically for the static static topology of the spin wave. And let me also mention one thing. One last piece is this Damon-Ashbach load. So this is not really my work. It's Yamamoto et al. But I think it's really worth mentioning because this is experimentally observed long time ago in 1970s and so on. So, and let me write down the reference. So this is 2019. Let me try to find the paper. Okay, 1905, 07, 909. And the experimental measurement is really a very, very long time ago. The first theory proposal by Damon and Ashbach is 1960s. And the experimental observations through the Brillouin light scattering is done in 1977 by Grunberg and in this case, the key point is that we need to consider long-range interaction. So this is, again, another counterpart which does not exist in electronic band structure. So in a magnetic system, you always generally have long-range dipole-dipole interaction. So you can have, for example, let's say in this simplest model, to demonstrate this phenomenon, the Hamiltonian you need to have is just a magnetic field along all the z direction and plus the dipole-dipole interaction. Let me call R and R prime and alpha beta partial 1 over R minus R prime partial R alpha partial R prime beta S R alpha S R prime beta. So that's a dipole-dipole interaction. So if you again perform the linear spin wave Hamiltonian, you can again get some Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian also has a very simple form. This matrix R, in my notation, in the k-space, it looks like some H naught, which is a constant. This is identity times identity matrix plus sigma x times matrix sk, sorry, plus sigma z times matrix times some number ck. So this sk and ck turn out to be singular. Because we know whenever we have long-range interaction, once you do Fourier transform, it's singular in k-space, right? So for example, sk has a form of, roughly speaking, 2kx ky divided by k squared if the magnetic order is along z-direction, and sck is roughly kx squared minus ky squared divided by k squared. So you can obviously see in the kz equal to zero plane, both of them are singular function. They are not analytic nearby around k equal to zero. In fact, you can show they are not analytic around k equal to zero, zero pi, pi zero, and pi pi, all these high symmetry, time-restful invariant momentum. So this singularity can be think about as some sort of monopole in k-space. So what you can do is, if you, in this case, in a kz equal to zero plane, this is my kz equal to zero plane. I have all these singular points. In this case, imagine you actually cut the surface state in the kz equal to zero plane. You look at the side surface of the system. And what you're going to observe is that if you go along this 1D line on the side surface in the k-space, so once you pass through the singularity, the 1D topological index for the system has to jump, just like in a wild semi-annotor, right? When you go past through a wild semi-annotor, the number jumps. So here, once you go along this line on the side surface, imagine you're able to measure some spectroscopy measurement, such as a Brillouin scattering here. You're going across this momentum. So I can think about this as a effective 1D system. And this 1D system has a certain topological index. This index is going to jump as you go from here to here. So in particular, you're going to see some basically flat band here, just like the edge state on the zigzag edge of the graphing between the k and k prime dr points. So they have some non-trivial. Actually, this one you can show is belongs to symmetric class C1. And this one has some zero mode in that situation.
What are the crosses in this case? Which points do they
represent? Just 0, 0. This is 0. Right. This is 0, 0. This is 0, pi. Pi 0. And this is pi pi. Yeah.
So basically, the point is the singularity is not both singularity k equals 0 and k equals pi pi.
But that's right, just across the whole thing.
But I meant the non-analyticity of sk
signal. Oh, it's only at 0 and pi, yes. It's only at 0 and pi, the non-analyticity, yeah. So that's the projection of the bulk monopole into the surface Brillouin zone. Yeah. So in that case, and the most striking thing is after you diagonalize this sort of Hamiltonian, you can see you have this identity part and this part. And this part have actually a chiral symmetry, anticlinal to sigma y. So in the end, after some algebra, what you can show is you end up with some surface state which is above all the bulk bands. So that's quite striking. We're never seeing that in electronic band insulators, but it somehow it's in these topological magnums.
This thing is kind of like quadratic band touching thing.
No. Oh, you mean in the bulk? Yes, yes.
No, I mean this 2x2 Hamiltonian that you described there.
Yes.
It describes the quadratic band touching.
Yes, essentially. But a little different, quadratic band touching are still analytic. But this one is singular, so it's like a phase
divided by
k square. Yeah. So it's kind of different. So so basically, in this case, what you can show is that if you diagonalize this part of this part of the Hamiltonian, you get some eigenvalue epsilon. Let me call it epsilon k. It doesn't have to be function k. but with open boundary, you can still have some surfacing. So the total eigenvalue for the system, what you can show is diagonalizing sigma y times r, is that the total eigenvalue, total frequency as function k is actually square root of h0 squared minus epsilon k squared. H0 is a constant here. So what you can show is if the second part, remember it has chiral symmetry, so it can give you zero mode. If this one is zero, you'll get some eigenstate which has eigenvalue h0. And for the bulk band, generally this eigenvalue is non-zero. So you get something lower. So bulk band is lower than the surface state in that situation. Yeah.
Okay. Could you repeat the statement about the surface states? At what dimension does it sit?
Zero frequency. Oh, no. Oh, not zero frequency. It's some higher frequency. So what I'm showing is that the bulk band, like I said, it looks like square root of h is 0 squared minus epsilon k squared. Epsilon k is the eigenvalue for this this sigma x sk plus sigma z ck. The surface state has epsilon k equal to 0. It's a 0 mode. So therefore, it's actually higher. Its energy just h0. Yeah, so this one is actually quite striking. If you do Brillouin scattering, you only see a Stokes peak, meaning absorption of the magma, and you don't see anti-Stokes peak. So with certain in-plane momentum direction. On the other hand, if you reverse in-plane momentum direction, you only see anti-Stokes peak, no Stokes peak. So it's a very sharp feature for these weird topological magnons. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then maybe let me take some very short time to comment on the flow kite dynamics for these magnons. If we don't have any question for this part. So generally, the flow kite dynamics is also a very complicated problem. You could have many, many different topological properties out of the drive, dynamical drive. But I want to talk about one case which is sort of proposing electronic system. And people have sort of understanding on this system. They also exist in the presence interaction. So they are called, I think people call them anomalous flowcat. Anomalous flowcat Anderson insulator. And so it's proposed by Rainer, Eritzberg, Nate Linder, and Michael Levin. I should say clarified by these persons in 2013. So this is actually a sort of a flowcat phases. So you are driving a system periodically, and you want to study, okay, what is happening after the periodic drive. So what you can show, there are certain cases where if you study the flowcat spectrum of the system, open boundary. So in the bulk, you can have certain, so once we have a flowcat, meaning the Hamiltonian actually has a time periodicity. So if this is the case, then you can see after you consider the flowcat drive, if you want to study actually, for example, the dispersion of the system, there is actually a sense of a quasi energy Brillouin zone. So energy has a periodicity of 2 pi over t. So therefore, you can define a quasi energy Brillouin zone plus pi over t, just like Bloch's theorem for the time translation, periodic time translation. So this you can view this as the Brillouin zone for quasi energy. So in that case, you can show if you try to diagonalize a bulk band in this flowcat system, the bulk band can all have Chern number 0. For example, if you have those bands, they have Chern number 0. But in spite of that, you still have surface state. So the surface state just flows through the whole system as you change momentum k. So and they meet at the boundary of the quasi energy Brillouin zone. So that's something which is proposed in some, say, electronic system, band structure, and also in some, say, interacting boson system. So here, what I want to show is, in this case of magnon, you can also sort of understand these anomalous flowcat dynamics. So the one first thing is that you could have a full classification for these kind of anomalous flowcat dynamics. So you could consider a unitary drive for these magnons. So remember, the magnon Hamiltonian is not Hermitian. So therefore, the unitary drive typically is not really unitary. So you can define a drive to be a time periodic integral minus r, integration of sigma y times r tau d tau from time 0 to t. You can define this drive. And this is turned out not to be a unitary. And you can ask yourself, what's the topology inside this drive? So in the case of this anomalous flowcat, anything is where what you can show is you need to consider a space-time topology for this object. You cannot just consider the Floquet operator, which is an evolution at for every period. You cannot consider this general Floquet operator. This operator alone doesn't give you this non-trivial anomalous topology. You need to consider the whole time evolution of this Floquet operator. So you need to compute space-time winding number for this system in order to get you this non-trivial topological state. And there is a way to understand that in terms of certain homotopy theory of the classifying space in this system. So I'm not going to go into detail, but I just want to say that in this case, although it's not Hermitian, although this is not unitary, I can also construct a Hermitian map. I can map this into a Hermitian matrix as a function of time t by the following Hermitian map, sigma y times ut, sigma y times ut inverse. If I construct this Hermitian map, I can show that this Hermitian matrix has a one-to-one correspondent to these unitary evolution operators. And by understanding topology for this Hermitian matrix, I can fully understand topology for this unitary matrix. Then I can fully classify the Floquet topology, anomalous Floquet topology in the Magnus. So in particular, again, let me consider these two different symmetry classes. So now I'm thinking about Floquet system. In the Floquet system, what you can show again is in 0, 1, 2 dimension, you have 0, z, and 0. So in 2D, you have an anomalous Floquet insulator, and in 1D and 3D, you don't have anything. And in the case, once you have time-reversal symmetry, again, everything is trivial, unfortunately. Yeah. So you can repeat this for all the other symmetry classes and so on. So by using this Hermitian map. So that's the first part. So maybe in the end, let me mention just one realization, semi-realistic realization. So the model is actually kind of simple. So imagine I have actually a compound, quasi 2D compound, with space group. So we don't know really a real material yet, but maybe someone here have an idea. Space group 47 is PMM. So the symmetry is basically you have mirror along x and y and z in the three direction. So it's a quasi 2D material. So you have magnet in the plane. So it's basically a rectangular lattice. You have two type of thing. Two sublattices are actually a little different. Imagine you have two different atoms on the two sublattices. One atom has a larger moment, a larger magnetic moment. The other atom has a smaller magnetic moment. Ferromagnetic is sufficient. The other one is smaller. And like I said, you have this mirror symmetry, Mx and My. Okay, I better hurry up. So once you have this symmetry, what you can write on the Hamiltonian, basically based on the space group symmetry. And you can have nearest neighbor Heisenberg, second neighbor Heisenberg, second neighbor Heisenberg. Let's say we keep things up to second order. So you have actually a J1 prime, and J2. Those are the only term in the Hamiltonian. And you don't have any DMA interaction due to symmetry. You can show that. Mostly MZ, mirror translation. And in this case, if you shine a light on the system, the lowest order coupling between the magnet and light is going to be given by the constant Hamiltonian plus the perturbation. Perturbation is the lowest order, it's the polarization, electric polarization of system. Multiply the electric field. Electric field usually oscillates as a function of cosine omega t. Okay. And the polarization with this space group, you can again write it down. So it actually contains a staggered hopping, which is plus J1 theta minus J1 theta along this y direction. If I'm considered y component of the polarization, it has this oscillation and something along x direction. And moreover, the polarization actually have a DM vector. You can have contain some DM sort of interaction between the second neighbors. So they have certain pattern in space. And you can show it repeatedly for the whole space. And the point is, initially before the driving, it's a ferromagnet. So the spectrum look like this. So at k equals 0, you have the lower band, higher band, because you have two sublattices. And what you want to do is you want to drive it at this frequency. it's a frequency difference between the top of the top of the higher band and bottom lower band. You drive at that frequency. And in that case, if you compute the Floquet spectrum, what you can show is adding this kind of perturbation. What you can do is you can open up a gap everywhere in the spectrum. You end up with two band. Both have turn number zero. And if you compute the Floquet operator and open boundary condition, you have actually edge mode going through both band on the system. So therefore, you have realization of these anomalous Floquet as an insulator in the system. OK, I think I'm going to stop here.
This DM interaction that's generated, it doesn't modify the ground state from being a separate thermite?
Yeah, assuming it's a weak drive. It's weak perturbation on top of the original habitat. So it's this term is small, meaning these gaps are also small.
But it's enough to modify your magnon Hamiltonian, but you don't have to take into account if the ground state itself is oscillating in time?
No, and it's not taking that. Okay. Well, assuming basically the magnetic load is not destroyed by the drive. Yeah, other than that, it's just become a much more complicated problem. Yeah, yeah. But this, at least for small trend, this may be a general strategy for all kind of magnets. Yeah.
Yes, I can ask a good question. So okay. You showed that in the class A,
yeah.
Let's say in two dimensions, you will have a non-zero, non-trivial bulk topology.
Yes, turn number basically.
Turn number. And yet you also said that when you look at these examples, that you do not have any non-trivial states.
Oh, you mean zero frequency?
Well, zero frequency.
Yeah.
So if you look at that example of class A, there is a non-trivial topology. How is that manifested?
Right. Good question. So yeah, I think I didn't really emphasize that, but that's the important part. So when I say non-trivial topology, is always the topology of the surface state between the two bulk bands. It's always at finite frequency, meaning this gap is always trivial. But these gaps between the two finite frequencies.
Exactly.
It's chiral edge state at finite frequency. Yeah, that's always the case for magna. You never have anything down here. Yeah.
And one more question. The T squared squared is 1.
Right.
In addition to class A and C1, there is one more class where that's, A1 and C1. There is also class BD1, the orthogonal class.
Right.
But T squared also squares to 1.
That's correct.
And is that realized in magnets in Langmuir systems?
I think so, yeah. BD1 just need timers, all right? Just timers, I say.
Yes.
Yeah.
Usually P squared is close to 1 as well.
This has become a little tricky. So BD1 typically is a superconductor with just timers, all right? Here, you see, if you want to focus on the topology of this one band, when I project into this one band, I have some sort of effective U1 symmetry, even though it's a superconductor. So in that case, it's again reduces to class A1. So I don't know whether BD1 is like legitimate symmetry when I talk about topology. Yeah.
And here, U1 is associated
with it's just a fake U1. It's a fake U1 of the, you think of BDG as a block band structure.
That's right.
So that kind of fake U1. Yeah.
Okay. All right, if there are no questions.